Welcome back for the third hour of Issues Etc. We're coming to you live this Tuesday. It's the 11th of October, back live for this week on the program. Dr. R. Scott Clark is our guest. Always a pleasure to talk with Dr. Clark, probably among all the Calvinists we know, the one who is most familiar with the Lutheran faith and the Lutheran confessions. I dare say knows more about the Lutheran confessions than many Lutherans do. The last time I had the opportunity to meet him and see him was at Concordia Theological Seminary, Fort Wayne, Indiana, one of their yearly symposia. He was there speaking to the gathered, 800 to 1,000 lay people and pastors there at Concordia Theological Seminary, Fort Wayne, Indiana, but one of the substantive gatherings they offer there on the campus of that seminary, among them the fall retreats for lay people and pastors. There are a whole number of them. You can find out more about them by going to our website, issuesetc.org, and look for the logo of Concordia Theological Seminary, Fort Wayne, Indiana. Find out about their fall retreats for lay people and pastors there on their campus. Or you can call them toll-free, 1-800-481-2155, 1-800-481-2155, Concordia Theological Seminary, Fort Wayne, Indiana. Having this conversation on Roman Catholicism and Reformation theology, oddly enough, Scott, on the very day, the anniversary of Exsurge Domine, the papal bull that excommunicated Martin Luther from the Catholic fold.
We should go find something and burn it outside some city gate somewhere.
Yeah, I don't know how long it took for the bull to get to him to burn it, but it's pretty clear there at that time that the break, and this was theological as much as political or sociological, the break between Luther and his theology and that of the papacy was pretty clean, wasn't it? I mean, this was not, well, let's just agree to disagree and part ways amicably.
Well, when you're eternally condemned and declared outside the Holy Catholic Church, at least I take that pretty seriously. It's not like it is in the States where and in the modern period where if you come under church discipline, you can just thumb your nose at the local parish and go down the street to second church and third church and fourth church. I mean, it was serious business, and I think it's probably difficult for us to imagine the sort of courage that Luther exercised in the face of really almost unimaginable pressure and odds. It's easy for us to put Luther in a box and say, well, he was. But if you think historically and think about the fact that no one had really put things as clearly and distinctly relative to the gospel as Luther did in the period between 1513 and 1521. As he gradually comes to an awareness that we're not justified by virtue of graciously wrought sanctity within us, but we're justified by the imputation of the alien righteousness of Christ, and that is received through trusting and resting in Christ. Honestly, you can find a lot of good things in medieval theology, and I read it with my students. You can find a lot of good things in the Fathers. But between Paul and Luther, very few people are as clear and articulate about that as Luther. And frankly, there was very little that prepared Luther to do that. There are things that made it possible. Some of that nominalist theology that he learned when he was in school did help to make the Reformation possible. That's certainly true. But it is really a truly remarkable thing. And we really need to make sure that we don't forget that, because there was a time not very many years before Luther was excommunicated when, almost nobody, I say almost because I just don't know of anybody who was putting things that way. And now we take it for granted.
One of the things we take for granted, of course, is a clear and scriptural definition of the word grace, not a word invented or coined by Luther or anyone else, but in fact, words straight out of the very heart of the Christian scriptures. What is it so commonly asserted nowadays, especially since 1998 and the signing of the Joint Declaration on the Doctrine of Justification between the Lutheran World Federation and the and the papacy, that Roman Catholicism and the Reformation share essentially the same definition of this word, grace. Is there a difference?
Yeah, well, there really is. And that was an unconscionable bit of equivocating. And really, what lies behind those kinds of agreements is an understanding of the nature of the relations between words and meanings that, as confessional people, we simply can't share. And the way modern people have talked about words is to, and theology, is to say, well, this is really just a way of describing our religious experience. And that way of talking goes back to the father of liberal theology, Friedrich Schleiermacher. Schleiermacher reduced all theology to the feeling of divine dependence. And so theology is simply a way of talking about religious experience. So if our religious experience is essentially common, that is, between Protestants and Roman Catholics, then really our theology can be said to be substantially common. And that's exactly what's happening. I mean, among the evangelicals, Cardinal Cassidy, who is the, or at least was, I assume he's still alive, Idris Cardinal Cassidy, is the legate, papal delegate to the evangelicals, Protestants. And what he does is he pulls people aside and he says, look, you know, I was born again in 1975 or 76 or whenever it was, and I read my Bible every day and I love Jesus. And evangelical scholars have testified that they had no idea that Roman Catholics read the Bible or have a personal, living, religious, spiritual encounter with Christ. And that's what has pushed, I can't speak for the LWF, but that's certainly what has pushed American evangelicals to rethink their relations to Rome. But so to answer your question specifically, no, we don't have. If you're confessional and you mean by grace what we've always meant, there are quite different definitions. Rome says grace is really the divine substance with which we are infused. It gets communicated to you. I'm looking at the second edition of the most recent Catholic Catechism, and it speaks explicitly of grace being communicated. Traditionally, she's spoken of infused grace that creates in us three virtues, three theological virtues, faith, hope, and love. And the greatest of these, of course, is love, as Paul says. So love is what's being formed in you or created in you by grace. And all of this is just code, I think, for divinity, for the divine essence, the deity is being infused in us a little bit at a time through the sacraments so that we can do our part and climb the ladder to God. Well, our definition, the confessional Protestant definition, couldn't be any farther away from that. We say that grace is the unmerited favor of God, that God is favorable towards sinners for no other reason than he wills to be. It's free. It's not necessary. He doesn't owe it. And it's certainly not his substance that he gives to us. It's not a medicine, as the medieval theologians spoke. It's an attitude, it's a stance, and its corollary is mercy. You know, grace is giving to sinners what they don't deserve, and mercy is not giving to sinners what they do deserve, that is punishment. So you have two very different definitions of grace. But if you've, you know, instead of burning the canon law outside the gates of Wittenberg, if you've burned the confessions, and in effect, you know, by calling them, you know, just historical relics, then you can redefine terms willy-nilly and make them say whatever you want.
So I was taught in the seminary, and this one has always stuck with me, that one of the basic differences between Rome and the Reformation on both the definition and the issue of grace is that Rome locates grace coming from God, but locates grace in man, per se.
Mm-hmm.
And the Reformation always says, no, grace is something that is in God. It is the favorable disposition of God toward sinners for Christ's sake, and it is always located in him outside of us rather than coming from him somehow poured into us.
Well, that's right. I mean, that especially relative to justification, that, you know, we are not right with God because he has graciously begun to work sanctity in us. Remember, in the Roman scheme, truly said, according to Rome, no one is ever justified in this life, or almost no one is ever justified ordinarily. I mean, there might be an extraordinary case, but in Rome, you're only justified to the degree that you are sanctified. And you're only sanctified to the degree that you cooperate with grace. And so grace works in you, and it begins to conform you to Christ, begins to make you holy, begins to actually intrinsically within you make you just. And then God looks down from heaven, as it were, and says, well, yeah, he's almost justified, or he's a little bit justified, but he's not there yet. For us, we say, Christ has fulfilled all merits. We have no merits of our own, no merits being wrought in us even. Christ has merits, however. Christ merited God's favor because he actively fulfilled all of the law of God. He fulfilled righteousness for us and actually satisfied the law of God. And all that Christ did is credited to us. So that when God looks at us, as Luther says in his 1535 commentary on Galatians, God doesn't see our sins relative to justification. He may see them in his providence, but not relative to righteousness before God. And that's because we are perfectly righteous presently now by grace alone through faith alone. So those are two very different stories of how people stand before God. For Rome, it's a process, and for us, it's a definitive event.
And someone who would say, look, coming back to what you mentioned before, very briefly, someone who would say, no, what Rome is just using one word where Protestants use two. when they say justification, they mean what Protestants mean by justification and sanctification. So we're not really quibbling over anything. They're just using a more broader term, more inclusive term there. But their theology is still straight as far as the particulars go.
Well, no, because you can't conflate justification and sanctification. That's the whole point. You've conflated law and gospel. I mean, in the nature of the case, either the righteousness of God is outside us and credited to us, or it's being worked within us. Now, relative to justification, either justification is a process or it is an event. By conflating the two, Rome postpones justification, final justification, until the day when we are intrinsically just. And there's just no way to synthesize that account of justification with our account. We don't believe that we will be justified. In fact, that's why, at least in Reform circles, we talk about vindication at the last day, though it may not have been always evident in this life because of the theology of the cross. At the last day, we will be vindicated, and it will be made clear that, in fact, we really did belong to Christ, that we really were righteous, whatever anybody thought. So we're justified now and vindicated later. According to Rome, justification and vindication are the same thing, and they're really postponed till the final day.
All right, then, to stay with the formula that is so common to the Reformation, justification by grace through faith for Christ's sake alone, what does Rome make of faith?
Well, faith is one of those three virtues that Paul describes in 1 Corinthians 13, faith, hope, and love. And they're really three ways of talking about the same thing, according to Rome, where we would say faith is this resting, trusting in Christ and his finished work for us. They say that faith is a measure of sanctity. It's created within the righteous, gradually infused in the soul, and this is really Roman language right from the Catechism, and exists partially in this life to the degree that the sinner cooperates with grace. So you have seven sacraments in the Roman communion, of which the layman participates in several, but not all, marriage, baptism, the Mass, communion, you know, and so forth, last rites, or extreme unction. And all of those are ways by which grace is infused into you to enable you to cooperate and accumulate condign merit. Right? That's a merit that God has to reward because he has wrought righteousness within you by his Spirit, and faith is a part of that process. So it involves trusting, but it's not just trusting. It's also being sanctified. So in a sense, Rome says that faith is faithfulness. Rome retranslates Galatians 5 to say not faith operating through love, but faith formed by love. In other words, love is a code word for sanctity and obedience to God. So to the degree that you have holiness and righteousness and obedience to God, to that degree you have faith.
Now, Rome has been and still is, and then the unwitting proponents of Roman theology are still also fond of saying, look, the Lutheran view is just deficient because the Reformation view is deficient because it would lead the sinner to conclude that there is such a thing as kind of nude faith. Yeah. I simply intellectually assent. Nothing else occurs in my life, I go to heaven. Yeah. And they say, no, faith is never alone. Therefore, works have to be a part of the system here.
Yeah, this is the difference between the theology of the cross and the theology of glory. The theology of glory says that the Protestant or biblical or Pauline account of faith is just too easy and too simple and will lead to all kinds of bad consequences, and therefore we have to change it, really, and say that sanctity is a part of being justified, obedience is a part of being justified, the law is a part of being justified, or else people won't obey. Well, that all makes very good sense. I mean, if you're trying to get people to obey the law and behave themselves, well, if you tell them, you know, that it's free and that God loves you and he accepts you on the basis of Christ's righteousness, and now go and be what you are, well, people don't really have an incentive, so you've got to give them incentive to obey, so let's make their final state dependent in part on their cooperation with grace. It's all very reasonable, but the problem is Christianity in that respect isn't reasonable. That's why Paul calls it the foolishness of the gospel and the foolishness of the cross. I mean, if the Christian faith were reasonable, God the Son wouldn't have two natures and in one person, and the Trinity wouldn't be one God with three persons. I mean, we could just flatten out all kinds of difficulties. God wouldn't be sovereign, and human beings wouldn't be responsible. You could just get rid of all those difficulties.
We were talking recently, actually it was almost a year ago now, with Dr. Martin Noland of the Concordia Historical Institute here in St. Louis, and talking about the Reformation. And he said, among many other things, he said, you can look at the Reformation as essentially a debate about good works. Yes, it includes all these other things, but when it finally came down to the real rub in the Reformation was what do you do with works? And he referenced, of course, the other documents that you had talked about, Dr. Clark, early in our conversation, how the Lutherans finally had to sort this out in the Formula of Concord and the Book of Concord. What place does Rome assign good works as opposed to that of the Reformation?
Well, the Protestants all agreed that, and Luther was very clear about this from the very earliest stages of his Protestant development, 1518, 1519. Just today I was reading his sermon on the three kinds of righteousness, and it's very clear in his sermon on the two kinds of righteousness, even clearer, I think, that you're justified, you know, by the imputation of Christ's righteousness, but that produces in you, that does result in sanctity, and you ought to live in that and live as if you have been declared righteous and have been made a new person. And Luther, in his disputation with Melanchthon in 1536, is very clear about that you don't tell the sun to shine, it simply shines. Why? Because it's the sun. Christians now are Christians by the grace of Christ, and so they ought to live that way and have the fruit of the Spirit. You don't say ought, you just say do or is, because that's what's going to happen. So the Protestants all agreed that sanctity necessarily, logically, morally flows. It's a logical necessity, a moral necessity. It flows out of being justified. If someone says to me, I have no need to be sanctified. I have no need to obey the law. I can do what I want. I can, you know, commit adultery, steal, murder, and there's no consequences. Luther says, and he, that's a virtual quote, he says, this person's not a Christian. A Christian doesn't speak that way. Rome says, well, that's just not satisfactory. And unfortunately, lots of evangelicals and some confessional Protestants have said, well, that's not satisfactory. You'll never get people to behave that way. That'll never work. You've got to make works a part of the way that we relate to God, not just out of gratitude. If you make it just gratitude, it'll never be enough. People won't do what they really ought to do. So it really comes down to, are we going to trust God, take him at his word, or are we going to try to fix Christianity to make it a little bit more reasonable?
Is this why Rod Rosenblatt, I think it's Rod who says this, Christianity is not the move from vice to virtue, but the move from virtue to grace?
Well, yeah, I think there's a lot of truth in that. I mean, the point of Christianity is not to make people virtuous. I mean, Christians ought to be virtuous, and indeed, by the grace of Christ, they shall become, to some degree, virtuous. But Christianity, at the end of the day, really is about salvation from sin and judgment. And then that results in a change. And, I always tell my students, you cannot fix Christianity. There's just no way. It is what it is. And every time we try to fix it by making it a little more reasonable, a little more amenable to what, you know, people are willing to accept, to that degree, you really don't have Christianity.
Finally, with only 30 seconds, Scott, do these basic differences that we've outlined here between Rome and the Reformation account for, in essence, all the other differences that exist between the two churches?
Absolutely. And there's, honestly, I would love to sit down with Cardinal Cassidy or whomever and have an honest discussion about the real differences. I think that would be very interesting and helpful. I think the time for equivocating is past. We need to get to grips with these plainly. And American evangelicals need to get to grips with this right away, or they're going to lose a great inheritance.
Dr. R. Scott Clark is Associate Professor of Historical and Systematic Theology at Westminster Theological Seminary in Escondido, California. He's author of a Reformation chart, very useful, by the way, in the latest issue of Modern Reformation magazine. Scott, thanks for being our guest.
Great to be here. Thanks.
All right, when we come back from this break, the last half hour of Issues Etc. is ahead. That, by the way, is just one of the first conversations we're going to be having here during the month of October on the Reformation, kind of making it a theme throughout the Reformation month as well. When we come back, we're going to turn to some matters, well, of the left-hand kingdom, namely the Supreme Court. The president's nomination is Harriet Myers. The question marks are still flying all over the place. We'll be hearing about 10 minutes of audio from Tim Russert's Meet the Press. He'll be talking with Dr. Richard Land and Pat Buchanan about the prospect of Harriet Myers on the Supreme Court. These two men disagree. I want to know what you think. Which of these two men do you agree with? We'll have that audio on the other side for the next 25 minutes of Issues Etc.
Grace, faith, scripture, and Christ alone. You're listening to Issues Etc.
Jesus, our Savior, said, "Let the little children come to me and do not hinder them, for to such as these belong the kingdom of heaven." It's never too early to begin instructing your children and your grandchildren in the truths of the Christian faith. For our Issues Etc. Book of the Month for October, we're offering a series of 6 children's books called Follow and Do. This series is a catechism for small children. The Follow and Do series includes a book on the Ten Commandments, the Creed, the Lord's Prayer, Baptism, Confession, and the Lord's Supper. This set of 6 books is $33.99 plus shipping and handling. For more information about the Follow and Do series, go to our website, issuesetc.org, and look for the Issues Etc. Book of the Month for October. Or call Concordia Publishing House, 1-800-325-3040, 1-800-325-3040.
Dinosaurs, rediscovered in the 1800s.
Answers with Ken Ham, author of the free booklet, What Really Happened to the Dinosaurs? Well, Ken, I'm kind of confused here. What do you mean by saying dinosaurs were rediscovered? In fact, I thought it was the 1800s when their bones were first being discovered.
Mark, most people have the idea that we found out about the existence of dinosaurs when scientists discovered and examined their bones back in the 1800s. But think about it. This idea is really based on an evolutionary belief that teaches that dinosaurs never lived with people. If you build your thinking on the Bible, all land animals, including dinosaurs, were made on day 6 of the creation week. So they actually did live beside Adam and Eve. Therefore, when scientists say that we first discovered the existence of dinosaurs in the 1800s, we say that from a biblical perspective, they actually rediscovered them. You know, Mark, I believe that the many dragon legends from cultures around the world are really most likely stories about creatures we now call dinosaurs. Dragons are actually referred to a number of times in the Old Testament. And remember also that the word dinosaur wasn't coined until 1841. So when someone asks the question, when were dinosaurs discovered? You say, well, starting from Genesis, they were first discovered about 6,000 years ago when Adam saw the first dinosaurs.
Ken Ham answers more of your questions about dinosaurs in his free booklet. It's available on our website, AnswersRadio.com.
Pastor Chad Bird, Associate Professor of Old Testament at Concordia Theological Seminary, Fort Wayne, Indiana, on why you should consider scheduling a visit to their campus today.
The church is always in need of pastors to preach the gospel and to administer the sacraments. And so we love to have any men who are interested visit our campus, learn what goes on here, sit in on classes, get a feel for what it's like to attend the seminary, and to consider the ministry as a calling in order that God might be served in the preaching of His Word and the giving of His gifts.
To schedule an on-campus visit at Concordia Theological Seminary, Fort Wayne, Indiana, call them toll-free 1-800-481-2155, 1-800-481-2155, or go to our website, issuesetc.org, and look for the Concordia Theological Seminary logo.
The 5th Annual Missouri Historical Society Trivia Challenge is Friday, October 14th at 7 p.m. at the Missouri History Museum, Lindell and DeBolivar in Forest Park. Teams of 10 members will compete for the coveted title of Missouri Historical Society Trivia Champions, with prizes going to everyone on the first, second, and third place teams. Admission is $5 per person, $2 if you're a member. Missouri Historical Society Trivia Challenge tickets are on sale now at the Missouri History Museum. Visit mohistory.org for more information.
Welcome back for the last 25 minutes of Issues Etc. Some very interesting audio to share with you here in the last 25 minutes on the issue of Harriet Myers and her nomination to fill the vacancy expected from Sandra Day O'Connor. Right now, the Supreme Court is up and operating with a full 9 justices. Sandra Day O'Connor has agreed to sit there in spite of her retirement. Until her successor is sworn in. The question is, will it be Harriet Meyer, the one that the president has chosen? She is, by all accounts, as big a question mark as John Roberts ever was, if not a bigger one. She has a different background than John Roberts. I think it's safe to say that she was not received by the president's supporters with the same kind of enthusiasm that John Roberts was received. It is of note that in the St. Louis Post-Dispatch today, a big story, Dr. James Dobson has come out and said, you know, after a conversation with Karl Rove, the president's chief political advisor, he now knows things about Harriet Myers that he's not at liberty to discuss, but things that have led him to throw his support behind her nomination. Well, this was a topic of conversation all throughout the weekend, especially on Sunday morning during most of the news programs. One of them, Meet the Press with Tim Russert, took up the subject. And in the course of a conversation with Dr. Richard Land of the Southern Baptist Convention and Pat Buchanan, two completely different viewpoints on Harriet Myers was expressed. We're going to play that audio for you. And I want to know from you on the other side of this audio, which of these two men do you agree with? Which one makes more sense to you when it comes to the Harriet Myers nomination? If time permits, we'll also get to some sound bites from Face the Nation with Senator Sam Brownback, expressing some guarded optimism about Harriet Myers and her nomination to the U.S. Supreme Court. Our call-in numbers in the last 25 minutes here of Open Lines, 505-7850 or 1-800-730-2727. This is from Sunday's Meet the Press with Tim Russert. Russert begins with a question for Richard Land on Harriet Myers.
If Harriet Myers on the court voted not to overturn Roe versus Wade, would that be a betrayal of trust?
Well, that depends on the case. They're supposed to interpret the Constitution. I believe that she will be open to doing it if it's the right case. I'd give the same answer with John Roberts. We want Supreme Court justices who will understand their client is the Constitution, and they're going to interpret the law. They're not going to try to write the law from the bench. And I believe, given the right case, she will vote to overturn if it's the right case. I'll make a prediction for you. When she's confirmed over the next 5 years, she and John Roberts will disagree about 1% of the time.
Mm-hmm. Do you believe that Roe versus Wade will be overturned if Roberts and Myers were both on the court eventually?
That depends on who the next nominee is. If my arithmetic's right, even if they both voted to overturn Roe with the right case, Kennedy would be the swing vote, and I don't think Kennedy would vote to do it. It's going to have to be one additional justice.
Here's what's concerning to many people, and this is from E.J. Dionne's column in Washington Post. Rather mysteriously, Dr. James Dobson of the Focus on Family, who was briefed on the nomination by Bush's Chief Lieutenant Karl Rove, told Fox News, "I do know things I'm not prepared to talk about here." He was equally cagey with the New York Times. "Some of what I know, I'm not at liberty to talk about." The intrigue whetted the curiosity of Ken Salazar, Democrat of Colorado, who said if the White House gives information to James Dobson, that information should be shared equally with the U.S. Senate. Did anyone from the White House suggest to you that Ms. Myers has expressed a view about abortion as opposition to Roe versus Wade?
No, not to me.
Nothing.
No. I don't know what Dr. Dobson is talking about. You'd have to ask him that question. When Karl Rove called me on Monday morning, he just told me who it was and told me the president had absolute confidence in her and gave me some of her background and some of the people that I knew in Dallas that knew her and who had vouched for her. But let me make one thing perfectly clear. I think that John Roberts' devout Catholicism and Harriet Myers' strong evangelical belief should be irrelevant when it comes to judging cases before the Supreme Court. In politicians, in governors, in senators, in congressmen, it's very important, and they have a right to bring their faith convictions to bear on public policy. But when it comes to judges, they must set aside their personal convictions and rule based on the law.
Pat Robertson, however, said that it is important that evangelical be on the court. It seems as if Republicans are saying it's now important to use religion, as opposed to when Catholicism was brought up with John Roberts, conservatives said that's not fair game.
Oh, I think whether she's an evangelical or whether John Roberts was a Catholic or whether someone is of another faith should be irrelevant when it comes to their qualifications for the Supreme Court.
Pat Buchanan, the National Right to Life Committee, has endorsed Harriet Myers. The Associated Press wrote about her record this way. On the issue that commands the most attention for court nominee Myers, pressed unsuccessfully to have the American Bar Association put its policy in favor of abortion rights to a vote of the membership, showing a sensitivity at least to the anti-abortion movement, if not outright support of it. Judge Nathan Hecht said she had attended an evangelical church in Dallas, the Valley View Christian Church, 25 years, and their position is pro-life. I'm sure her views are compatible. Myers bought a $150 ticket to a Texas anti-abortion group's fundraising dinner in 1989, the year she won a term on the Dallas City Council. We can show you that program from that dinner, Texas United for Life, Harriet Myers, Dallas City Council. She is a bronze patron supporting that Right to Life dinner. And then this, as political activists rush to mine Supreme Court nominee Harriet Myers' slender public record, a former campaign manager says she opposed abortion rights while running for Dallas City Council in 89. Quote, she's on the extreme end of the anti-choice movement, says Laura Lee Bartos, who managed the Myers' first and only political campaign. So they discussed abortion once during the race. Ms. Bartos said Ms. Myers was supportive of abortion rights in her youth. She said Myers then underwent a born-again, profound experience that caused her to oppose abortion. Isn't that good enough for you?
Listen, there's a possibility she will vote to overturn Roe v. Wade. But what we've heard here, Tim, is trust, believe. Why should we take this risk? Anti-communism and the Supreme Court are the great causes of conservatism in my lifetime. Ronald Reagan led us to victory in the Cold War. We were on the precipice of victory in the battle to return the Supreme Court to constitutionalism. And the President of the United States picks a woman of no known judicial philosophy who has never taken a stand on any of these great questions, who has never written or said anything about Supreme Court rulings, and we have been told to take it on faith. At the same time, we have half a dozen nominees. You've got Luttig, you've got Priscilla Owens, Janice Rogers Brown, Alito, countless others we've been preparing, if you will, and grooming, who have taken heat, who have taken abuse for their beliefs and convictions, who are as certain in their judicial philosophy as Robert Bork was, and then we are handed a tabula rasa, a blank slate, whose commendation, according to White House briefers, is she's never taken a stand. This White House has ducked a fight. It has backed away from a fight. The President has recoiled from greatness. He has retreated from Reaganism into the old politics of compromise and consensus on what, for us, was the greatest issue of his second term. I think, in a minor matter, he has probably risked his legacy. But more important, he has risked what some of us have fought for 40 years since I was with Richard Nixon.
On Tuesday, the President had a news conference, and Kelly O'Donnell of NBC kept asking him whether he'd ever talked to Harriet Myers about abortion, and here's part of that discussion.
In my interviews with any judge, I never asked their personal opinion on the subject of abortion.
In your friendship with her, you
never not to my recollection, have I ever sat down with her. What I have done is understand the type of person she is and the type of judge she will be.
Now, she was deputy chief of staff during the entire partial birth abortion discussion debate when the president signed the legislation. Could it be the president never talked about abortion with Harriet Myers, even during that debate and discussion in the Oval Office?
You'd have to ask the president that question. I mean, you know, the president says that he's never asked her about those issues, and I take his word for it to the best of his recollection. But I will say this, and I want to reiterate this. I have checked this with my White House sources. This woman was very much involved, intimately involved, in the vetting process for the stellar list of nominees the president has put forward again and again and again, put forward nominees that are strict constructionists, original intent jurists, and never backed away, even in the face of an unprecedented filibuster under Daschle and Leahy. He never backed down. And, you know, the idea that George W. Bush shies away from a fight, I don't think so.
Pat Buchanan, the president saying he never discussed abortion with Harriet Myers.
I find that, well, look, I'm not going to challenge the president's word. but look, I mean, I still don't understand why, when you have someone as solid as you have, you would choose someone with a complete blank slate. The president says this is the most qualified person to serve on the Supreme Court. Why then was she passed over for counsel? Why was she just a staff secretary? Tim, on abortion, I am not sure the President of the United States wants to see Roe v. Wade overturned. His wife does not. His mother does not. He refuses to say whether he wants to see Roe v. Wade overturned. There are a number of Republicans, moderate Republicans, who say, well, this would be a political disaster. I'm not sure the President of the United States wants the Supreme Court to overturn Roe v. Wade. And the President ought to answer that question.
I am. I'm absolutely certain.
Has he ever told you that?
No.
How do you know?
I know how he feels about abortion. I've talked to him about it. I've seen the look in his eyes. I've seen the anguish in his face, the pain in his heart. This, for him, is not just a moral issue. It is a deep issue of conviction, and he wants to see this decision returned to the people of the United States. Let's do understand now.
This is very important. In your mind, Doctor, he would be disappointed if Harriet Myers did not vote that way on the Supreme Court.
Given the right case, yes. Given the right case, given a, you know, let's do understand, it has been the law of the land since 1973, but so had Plessy versus Ferguson for 58 years before Brown versus the Board of Education.
Okay, that's Richard Land ending off the conversation between Pat Buchanan, Land, and their moderator, Tim Russert, on Meet the Press on Sunday. I want to know what you think. That's the first time I've ever heard a public figure, even Pat Buchanan, who's not a public official, but a public figure, expressed doubt as to whether or not George W. Bush wants to see Roe v. Wade overturned. That's the first time I've ever heard it. Made my eyes pop open. and raise some questions in my mind as well. So which of these men do you agree with when it comes to Harriet Meyer? Richard Land of the Southern Baptist Convention is guardedly optimistic about her prospects on the court. He believes that, as he said several times, given the right case, she would vote to overturn Roe v. Wade, although he was clear to point out that even her vote, added with the others on the court, would not do the job. They need one more nomination against Roe and eventually confirmed to the court. Or do you agree with Pat Buchanan, who is far more skeptical about the issue of Roe, even skeptical about the president's own will to have Roe overturned, and didn't sound altogether as though he believed the president when he said he had never discussed abortion with his Supreme Court nominee, Harriet Meyers? 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. Is she still too much of a question mark for you? Or do you like James Dobson and National Right to Life and other groups, even pro-choice groups who are opposing her nomination? Do you think that she would, when it comes to the life issue, she would be a good Supreme Court justice? 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. I want to know where you fall in this debate on Harriet Meyer's nomination for the U.S. Supreme Court. It will be decided here by the Senate in some time. And, of course, we're not going to be voting there. We're not going to be voting in any case. But if you did vote for this president, many have said we voted. We had Phyllis Schlafly on last week, and she was on fire. She said we voted for this president based upon the fact that he would put the right person on the court when given the opportunity. And she said she saw this. She called it political cronyism, the nomination of Harriet Meyers to the U.S. Supreme Court. Here's the question that Tim Russert asked. He said, look, National Right to Life has endorsed her. James Dobson supports her now. That story's in the Post. Her Dallas church is a pro-life church. She donated to a pro-life group. She has the opposition of pro-choice groups under her belt. Is it good enough for you? That's my question for you as well. 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. It's open lines, issues, etc. Talking about Meet the Press, Richard Land, Pat Buchanan disagreeing about whether or not Harriet Meyers is the person for the court. Now, remember here, the person whom she has been nominated to replace, Sandra Day O'Connor, was, they call her a swing vote on some issues. She voted with a more liberal majority on some cases. She voted with a more conservative majority on abortion issues. She was against partial birth abortion, but she also voted in that famous case, the Casey case, to reaffirm Roe as the law of the land. So when you're supporting a swing justice, do you want another swing justice? That's the real question here. I think Tim Russert's questions really get to the heart of this. And if you listen to Richard Land of the Southern Baptist Convention, he's basically saying, look, his prediction was that when the two have been on the court, they will only disagree when two, John Roberts and Harriet Meyers, have been on the court, they will disagree 1% of the time. So he's basically saying, Richard Land is saying, that Harriet Meyers is John Roberts in a dress. We're just looking at a repeat of John Roberts in terms of how we can trust their views on the life issue. Pat Buchanan, far more skeptical. What about you? 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. And I guess I have to ask the question, since Pat Buchanan so pointedly raised it, do you agree with Buchanan when he says he doubts whether or not George W. Bush really wants to overturn Roe v. Wade? He didn't say he doubted the president's position on abortion. I think that's clear for all to see. But he said he doubts whether or not the president wants to see Roe v. Wade overturned, because it would be a political, what would you call it, Katrina? It would be politically the battle royale, one of the big ones of American history, overturning Roe v. Wade. And it sounds as though Pat Buchanan doubts the president's resolve when it comes to overturning Roe v. Wade. Even Richard Land couldn't say that he had heard from the president himself that he would have it overturned. He had to appeal to the fact, well, I saw the look in his eyes, I saw the anguish on his face, I saw the anguish in his heart, and for that reason, he doesn't have any doubts that the president wants it overturned. If he wanted it overturned, one might ask, really wanted it overturned, then why put another question mark on the court? 505-7850-1-800-730-2727. Well, that was the audio from Meet the Press on Sunday morning. Meanwhile, on CBS's Face the Nation, there were many people weighing in on this, among them Kansas Senator Sam Brownback. He was asked at one point what his reaction was to the general lack of knowledge regarding Supreme Court nominee Harriet Myers.
We just don't know enough. We need a much fuller portrait of this person. And unfortunately, Bob, we're in a situation now in these judicial nominees that it seems as if you have somebody put forward with a clear judicial philosophy on some of the key issues of the day, and here you're talking about life and death cases, about the view of marriage, private property rights, that they can't get confirmed. They get filibustered. And so you get a candidate without a record, and there's not a whole lot to debate.
I mean, it sounds like he's, can I say, we're between a rock and a hard place. If we put someone up who the president, the kind of person the president appeared to have pledged he would put someone up when he was elected twice, if we put that kind of person up, they'd get filibustered. And so we put up a question mark. And then there's not a lot to debate, but we don't know what we're getting, and we just don't know enough about Harriet Myers. Do you feel like you know enough about her to say, well, if it's good enough for James Dobson, he claims to have heard something from Karl Rove this weekend that swung his support in favor of Harriet Myers. But he won't say what it is. Richard Land said he had a conversation with Karl Rove on Meet the Press. And he didn't hear anything of the kind. He didn't hear anything that really would have swayed his position on Harriet Myers. Is it good enough for you that National Right to Life endorses her? James Dobson now supports her. Her Dallas church, where she attends as an evangelical, is pro-life. She has donated at least on one occasion to a pro-life group. And that pro-choice groups, generally speaking, are coming out against her. 505-7850-1-800-730-2727. Then also on CBS's Face the Nation, Senator Sam Brownback of Kansas with Bob Schieffer was also asked how he thinks the Myers nomination is going to go.
This is a two-step process. The president nominates, the Senate advises and consents. We're in this second part of the process. I think it'll go on forward fully. A fuller picture of this nominee will come out, but I'm frustrated by the process.
All right.
Because I think we should have a vigorous debate about where candidates stand on the issues and have that discussion with the American people.
Okay, now, I understand what he's saying. I'm frustrated by the process, but the process is what it is. I mean, this is a constitutionally mandated process. President nominates, Senate confirms. I wonder whether or not the senator is frustrated by the process or by the woman who's been put into the process for consideration. It wouldn't necessarily be a frustrating process if everyone knew where Harriet Myers stood on these issues. Now, as a nominee, she's not going to be talking to the press. She will be talking to the Senate Judiciary Committee, of which Senator Brownback is a member. Do you expect Senator Brownback and the other pro-life senators on the Judiciary Committee to try and sort out what it is she believes? If she is the big question mark, if Richard Land says we don't know enough, if Pat Buchanan says we certainly don't know enough, if Senator Brownback says we don't know enough, then he says he wants a vigorous debate on the nominee's views, an open and vigorous debate. I would expect him to ask this question. It's the question they said that shouldn't have been asked of John Roberts, but if we want to know their views, it would be helpful to say, do you think Roe v. Wade is good law? Do you think there's a right to privacy in the Constitution as articulated by the Roe Court? What do you think of the basis, the legal basis, for the Roe decision? You don't have to ask them whether they'd vote to overturn. Just ask them their opinion on, ask her opinion. After all, her opinion will count at least as 1/9 of the decision should Roe ever come back to the court for reconsideration. You could ask a question like this. Do you consider Roe v. Wade a super precedent in constitutional law that cannot be overturned? Now, if we want to know her viewpoints, those are the kind of questions we could ask. Here's Senator Sam Brown back again. Here he's dealing with the whole filibuster issue he raised earlier in answer to, could, in the past, could they have gotten past a filibuster threat over pro-life judicial nominees?
If you don't support Roe, if you don't support abortion rights, you get filibustered. But I believe we could have overcome that filibuster. It would have required a bruising fight, changing the rules. But I think we're at a point in time that we should have that discussion and debate.
And then finally, here's Senator Brown back again on whether or not Harriet Meyer's religious viewpoints, and that's come up. John Roberts was a Roman Catholic. She's being referred to as an evangelical. I know the church she attends down there in Dallas, Texas, Valley View, an evangelical church. What role should her religious views play? Here's
Brown. It shouldn't be about religious views. And indeed, in the hearings, John Roberts said, my religious views will not impact how I look at the law. And I presume that Harriet Myers will do the very same thing.
This is a crucial moment in American history. There's no doubt about it. I mean, it's a rarity for a president to get the opportunity within the course of 3 months to nominate and see confirmed two Supreme Court justices. And it's the amazing thing is we're just barely into this president's second term. And it is very likely, not inevitable, but very likely that he might have an opportunity to do one more nomination. So John Roberts was questionable, but then proved a little stronger under scrutiny. Harriet Myers is very questionable, and we'll see how she proves under scrutiny. This president was elected, of course, as many of our guests pointed out, for the purpose of reconstructing the court and perhaps even overturning Roe v. Wade. And for the first time I've heard, someone seriously raised the question of whether or not this president wants to see Roe v. Wade overturned. Tomorrow on the program, we'll be talking about the impact of Christianity on civilization. Jonathan Hill will be our guest. He's author of a new book called What Has Christianity Done for Us? And we'll also talk about the fivefold fallacy with Bob Lico of Discernment Ministry International. Before we go, LCMS World Relief is a proud underwriter of Issues Etc. They are, as we speak, continuing ongoing Christ-centered, cross-focused relief efforts for Katrina and Rita victims, as well as other natural disasters. Think about the giant earthquake in Pakistan and all those that are still suffering and will suffer. For more information on how to support all of these through LCMS World Relief, go to our website and look for their logo, LCMS World Relief. Our website, issuesetc.org. I'm Todd Wilkin. Thanks for listening to Issues Etc.
Listen weekday afternoons to Issues Etc. Issues Etc. is a listener-supported program. Your financial support is critical for the continuation and expansion of this worldwide outreach. Our address is 85 Founders Lane, St. Louis, Missouri, 63105. You can donate by credit card on our resource line, 1-800-737-0172, 1-800-737-0172. For a free audio copy of this hour of Issues Etc., please visit the audio archive section at KFUO.org. Opinions expressed are not necessarily those of AM850 KFUO. Issues Etc. is a broadcast service of the Lutheran Church, Missouri Synod.